Hello and welcome to episode 62 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston.
And hello, Matt. Here we are, number 62 in the series of 1 million that we're currently engaged upon. How's your week been since we last met?
Back to work and some interesting meetings over the course of the week, actually. One of which you will be able to hear a little later. One of which you'll be able to hear next week, and one of which was about a potential new piece of work, which was fascinating, healthcare industry and how technology might be able to help, be able to reduce demand on services, but then a whole bunch of other dynamics involved in it that are kind of frying my head a bit, but in an interesting way, as well as a I don't really ever want to get old kind of way. How about you?
Yeah, another busy week some good opportunities opening up as well, some nice new little bits of work. I'm going to talk to an organisation about blockchain in the next few weeks, and just to see what, to give them an oversight of what it is and what they should be worried about. I'm going to see another company this week about what they're doing. So yeah, quite a lot of things coming out of the woodwork, as well as being really busy on the other work that I've got at the moment. So it's really good, actually. And I'm quite enjoying it. I think the fact that the sun has come out has helped to lift my spirits too.
Absolutely. Spring has indeed sprung, which is good. Oh, the other thing was I went to the Natural History Museum on Saturday with the boys. And we get up there and there's a usual queue outside. And it's like, oh, we're bored, Dad, we're bored. I can stay with it, it'll be fine. And then we get through the doors and it's like, oh, look, there's the blue whale. Where's Dippy? That's all good. And then, oh, we want to go and see the dinosaurs. And I said, oh, are you sure? Because we just queued for ages. Are you sure you really want to queue again? Yeah, we want to see the dinosaurs. So anyway, we went down to the dinosaur thing. And by Jove, the Natural History Museum is a fantastic case study in service improvement and how to be able to improve something with very simple changes, but to make a dramatic difference. There is no queue for the dinosaurs anymore. Because, I don't know if you've been there recently, but there's a walkway that goes over the top of the entire dinosaur gallery. And it's obvious the problem was that walkway was causing massive queue backs because it slowed people down and it was quite narrow. So they've just reorganised it. So the walkway, presumably they use it for events and stuff, we can have cocktails up there, but day to day, the walkway is no longer in commission. And it means you can just walk through the gallery like you can just walk through any of the other galleries. It's genius. Very simple. And means you can get to see the Tyrannosaurus Rex without having to queue for half an hour to be able to get in to then go past all the other stuff first. Brilliant.
There we go. Somebody's actually analysed some data or just had a flash of inspiration about how to get rid of a bottleneck in their organisation. I haven't been to the National History Museum for a while. I went there a few years ago and just had a look at them. So if you go in that entrance there with the where the dinosaur was and now there's the whale, I recommend looking up. The ceiling is amazing. It's the design of the ceiling is lots of little squares, and in each one is like a painting of a plant species essentially, and it's just covered in them, and it's almost like it's just a work of art, really, this whole ceiling. But you don't really see it unless you look for it. And I read about that first in a book that I read several years ago now, and it's called, I don't know, Dry Store Number 63 or something. And it's a book about the Natural History Museum written by a guy that worked there who with an unhealthy fascination with trilobites. But it is a good book, really interesting, and the story of the whole thing is really interesting. I recommend it.
I was just looking at the photo that I took of the new blue whale thing, and I was because looking up into the ceiling, and yeah, zooming in, I didn't notice at all, but it's incredible.
It is, it really is.
Absolutely fantastic. Yeah, you get that, and all on the outside of it as well, all the animals and stuff that are on the outside, and there's a few hidden away. There's a little monkey just as you're coming in round, which is in a kind of buttress that none of the others have monkeys in them. And fantastic bit of really gaudy Victorian architecture. I'm all for that. Anyway, on with the show.
So here we are with Yin and Yang, our weekly feature with no jingle. And I'm looking at you, Matt, because I think it needs a jingle. And you're the musician. I mean, I could do a jingle, but it'd be, I could just do a jingle of a squeaky chair. And people hear enough squeaks in our title music without that. So you've been looking at a couple of things. I think we should start with the Yang. Let's start with the good thing.
The good thing on the internet. There's this fantastic thing, and I don't. It's one of those wonderful sort of, is it a parody account or not? And it's a thing called Perfume Ads for Sale. It's on Twitter. It's just Perfume Ads, at Perfume Ads. And what they basically, every so often you'll get a synopsis for a television perfume ad. And I've always found, especially as you get in the run-up to Christmas and all the TV advertising you get for gifts for people who can't think of what to buy for other people, but you have to buy them something because that's what Christmas is all about. And perfume ads are just odd. And they're consistently just a bit weird. And so what this ad for, this Twitter account is doing is just basically, I just say, I don't know if it's a pastiche or not. It says if you want to buy any of them, they're all guaranteed dead certs, £5,000 a pop. I'll give you an example of one. Ewan McGregor on a motorbike wearing a little scarf. Life. They say if you blink, you'll miss it. Ewan stares at his reflection in a lake. That's why. Face to face with a coyote. I never blink. Ewan atop a mountain staring intensely at the sky. Thunder. And you see, I mean, it is just, it's so much like the reality of perfume ads. It's bloody brilliant and I love it.
Where can I buy this perfume?
Ewan McGregor's Coyote. There you go. So that's the Yang this week.
Okay. Well, that's, I mean, that's a, it's a very Yangy thing. So let's talk about Yin. Let's go into something in a bit more detail because you've selected something which is a hobby horse of this, the podcast, which is the artificial intelligence.
Yes. Today, the House of Lords group on artificial intelligence has published a big report called AI in the UK, Ready, Willing and Able. And they've spoken to lots of people. They have got, it's a very comprehensive thing. It talks about the history of artificial intelligence. It talks about where it is today. It talks about opportunities. Da, da, da. But it, for me, reinforces even more two things. First of all, that I don't understand why we are calling out artificial intelligence as a thing when it is just a technique for coding, effectively. And the systems that you might use it in aren't artificial intelligence alone. You need a lot of other things. And so it's just computers. It's just software. It's just where software is going. And so it should be about a report into where software is going, because there's lots of other stuff. And then the other thing about it is it also continues to reinforce the anthropomorphic nature of calling this stuff intelligence when it just so obviously isn't intelligence. And by anthropomorphizing it, leading us to stupid assertions like these technologies should be given ethical frameworks, which is absolute bobbins, because technology is amoral. Technology is, it cannot be good or bad in the context of ethics. It can be good or bad in the context of, I don't know, Manchester City as opposed to Luton Town, but by calling it intelligence and conflating ideas of what intelligence means, or not even defining properly ideas of what intelligence means, it means that we then do this thing that we seem as human beings to want to do all the time, which is to assign human characteristics to what are essentially inanimate objects. And that's very dangerous, because what it does is it obfuscates where the real blame is, which is on other human beings. It is not for machine intelligence, artificial intelligence, statistical programming techniques to be ethically good or bad. It is for the people who choose to deploy them. It is not for business industries to be ethically good or bad. It is for the people working in those things. And for as long as we think that there is something, you know, some sort of spirit within these machines, and by calling it intelligence, we are assigning it that kind of status, we are setting ourselves up for problems. And just as a, you know, starting out, there's a lot of interesting stuff in the report, but really early on it says that there isn't really a single agreed definition of artificial intelligence. And so we're going to go with the one that the government used in its industrial strategy white paper, which defined artificial intelligence as technologies with the ability to perform tasks that would otherwise require human intelligence, such as visual perception, speech recognition, and language translation. Now, I would argue that all of those things have been solved by statistical analysis, and that things that would otherwise require human intelligence could be things like spreadsheets, or could be things like a pocket calculator, or could be things like a knitting machine, because all of these things prior to the invention of those machines needed human intelligence for them to be able to have it. It's a nonsense definition. And from that point onwards, I just ask the question, why is this being treated differently?
So, there ends Matt's rant that is becoming a regular feature. So I'm going to take a different view. And not just for the purposes of argument, because I do think that the machine learning aspect of AI, if we want to call it that, and I do have a problem with the term, so I'm not going to argue the point there. We are now in a position where we can set a piece of software going, and not in the way that an expert system once upon a time would tell you that you were having a heart attack because you followed the symptoms down through the little binary tree, or that you weren't eligible for a loan or an interview or whatever it was, because it's following a well-defined, if highly complex, if very, very multi-layered, if hard to follow, but still it's something that is going to, if you drop the ball bearing in the top, it will always come out at the certain point at the bottom. And you know how it's been built, and you can show how it's been built. We are now building systems that learn, that decide to tell you that this picture is of a beach because it has learned what features a beach has. And sometimes it will show you something that's not a beach because it's got enough of the components to make the computer think it's a beach. And sometimes it won't show you a picture of a beach because it happens to be, you know, the beach happens to be a very dark color because it's in, I don't know, Lanzarote or something, and one of those carry-ons with a black sand. It will make mistakes, but over time it will learn based on more data. Now, of course, all that data has to come from us, but we are reaching a stage where, if not used correctly, a computer could be left to its own devices to make a decision that doesn't have the best interests of the person or people that the decision's about. And I agree that it's a business or a process issue that we should make sure that the, just like not putting the trainee in charge of the crown jewels, we shouldn't be leaving these things in charge. But just like putting inexperienced people in charge of important things, it does happen sometimes through cost saving and efficiency. In this sense, it can be done almost in the name of progress. So rather than me giving it to the apprentice, I can't say that's in the name of progress, but I can give it to the robot because that's seen as somehow whizzy and futuristic. So there are dangers there, and it is something that that should be addressed.
But this is nothing new, okay? I'll give you two examples. The first example is the international trading systems that exist around stocks, shares, equities, all the rest of it. And those, ignore what's behind the scenes at any individual bank and all the AI that they might be using or the algorithmic trading that they might be using. But the markets themselves have become completely unpredictable, uncontrolled things because of the interaction of multiple relatively, up until recently, relatively simple but very fast algorithmic systems. And the individual algorithms are all well known. It was the interaction of those things that led to unpredictability. And we've had that for decades now. And actually, take it even further. Actually, human systems, complex human systems, that's the way we are used to it. So, for example, the poor people who are the generations from the Windrush generation, who at the moment are trying to find out what is the madness behind completely irrational processes that are not working within the Home Office. And those are processes that don't have any bloody intelligence behind them at all. But have you, you know, it's like Bagatelle, you put a ball in the top and you don't know where it's going to come out the bottom. That's the way that processes in systems in organisations work. And so I don't see that the, yes, but it might come up with the wrong answer and we won't have an idea about why that is, should be a surprise to us. That's the way that big organisational bureaucracies work. And then the other thing about the report, one of the other things that I caught in the summary of it, I haven't read every page of this. I'll set some AI onto that and pull out the salient points for me later. But they also talk about how they want to be able to make sure that AI doesn't encapsulate biases, unfair discrimination going forward. At that point, you go, but all of these technologies are based on training on existent data of the current world. So these cannot exist without basing them on the biases that we have in our society already, because that's the way that these things have to learn. They have to learn on data that we have. So unless you ban the use of data to be able to learn, none of these, and that's the kind of logical fallacy that I think sits within all of this stuff. I just don't understand why we're...
There are a great number of logical fallacies and a great number of issues that are driven by anthropomorphism, as you say. But for example, financial systems, there is regulation. Or, you know, it might not have worked, but there is regulation. And in organizations where decisions are made, you're right, there are processes that then you can unpick and say, how do we make a better decision? The issue around the around machine learning is that that is not well understood, and it becomes so complex so quickly within the machine that it's essentially impossible for anybody to unpick it. And I don't think that I don't think it's a new thing. As I say, you could replace artificial intelligence with just
computers.
Intelligence, which is poorly. In terms of the kind of thought experiment here, you could replace the computer with somebody who's not very well trained to do their job. They're still more brilliantly more intelligent than a computer ever will be, because they have a human brain, but they don't have all the information or the experience to make a good decision. And what stops you doing that? And I think that's the question, because it will be so easy. In fact, it really is easy. I mean, the bloody WB40 bot's got an AI neural network behind it, and all it does is say what I don't understand. But you can teach them, you know, even something like me, you know, in about 2 hours of messing about once upon a time, can make a bot which uses an AI construct. So because it's so easy to create these things, I think the danger is there. And
I say if we take the WB40 bot as an example, I can't distinguish between the WB40 bot and a random number generator that's occasionally spewing out a list of 100 sentences, okay? And either of them, this is the point,
you don't talk to it, Matt. You don't give it any love.
Well, no, I don't talk to it because it's stupid. That's so judgmental, isn't it? But it's not intelligent. It's not a thing. But my point is that it's not that we shouldn't be regulating these things. It's that we should be regulating these systems full stop, whether they are artificial intelligence because they've got some sort of machine learning algorithmic thing behind them, or whether they're just simple processes being spewed out of SAP. The regulation shouldn't be dependent. The strategy shouldn't be dependent on a particular class of being technology being used, which for me is as arbitrary a decision as about whether you're using JavaScript or VB script to be able to do the front end.
Yeah, I think there's a fundamental difference with this technology that means it needs special attention. I do agree there that it is just another technology and will become commonplace as we start to demystify it, and a little bit like, you know, the automata of 100 years ago, that when you start to understand that actually the levers behind them are just cogs and wheels. They just happen to be massively complex cogs and wheels that we don't necessarily get to understand ourselves. It will become less phenomenal, if you know what I mean, in terms of how it's reported. So I don't disagree with you entirely. I do think that of the ethical considerations. The problem is, as soon as you start talking about ethics, people just start thinking about, you know, Asimov's three laws and HAL and all that kind of gubbins, which of course is, you know, arse gravy. So we have to get past that. I do actually. I saw on that report as well that the Lords, one of the things they'd done is they'd visited the BBC Blue Room for examples of how artificial intelligence is being used in the BBC. The Blue Room is it's a little exhibit in Birmingham in the mailbox where they show sort of new whizzy things that the BBC are doing, and it just makes me think of a charabanc pulling up to the House of Lords and taking them all on a day trip to Birmingham to go and see the machines at the mailbox. I find that quite pleasing. That cheers me up.
Fantastic. Well, I suppose if nothing else, it's doing the job of being able to provoke the debate about this subject. So that's good. But anyway, we'll put a link to it on the webpage. I still remain to be convinced that we should be especially, you know, focusing attention on artificial intelligence above anything else. It's the way that organisations deploy technology that's the issue, and the people in those organisations deploy the technology, not the technology per se.
I told the last word, didn't you?
Okay, now I've calmed down a bit. Time for an interview. This week I went to see Charlotte G, who is the editor of Tech World News, which is one of the brands that IDG have. And she's also the founder of a venture called Genio, which those two things we kind of talk about in the interview. And I guess over and above everything else, what we talked about is how we might make better events in the world of tech. And, well, here's what Charlotte had to say.
I am Charlotte G. I am editor of Tech World, and I have also founded a venture called Genio, which is aimed at boosting diversity within tech events specifically.
Fantastic. And that was kind of the spur for coming to have a chat with you. What's the issue?
Well, I'll try and sum it up as briefly as I can.
Okay, yeah.
The issue from my point of view, people know that there is an issue within tech. There aren't enough women, and there is a sort of diversity issue more generally. But where I found that being particularly acute was events. So you'll go to an event, there'll be a panel, everyone on the panel will be a middle-aged white guy. And then I thought, you know, this is a bit of a problem, because I know that it's not dealing with the sort of pipeline issue, and it's not dealing with other aspects, but it is dealing with the, you know, you can't be what you can't see. And if you can't see women sort of doing well in the industry, then it can be pretty off-putting. And it's a big problem within tech is lack of retention of women that have joined the industry. So actually just keeping women that have qualified in tech in some way to stay in the industry would be quite helpful. And I think one way would be, you know, helping them to sort of get a bit more profile. And so, yeah, so it's definitely not addressing the issue, but it's just like, okay, there's a little manageable chunk. Yeah. What can we do to try and improve that?
And so what, that was my plan. Practically, what has that meant?
Well, good question. So first off, I started making a list for Tech World, which I have to say has now got really out of hand. So it started off with me basically saying, you know, talking to event organisers and saying, well, how come there aren't any women on this panel? Well, there aren't enough women working in the industry. And I sort of thought, well, I know that there's not as many, but come on, like there's still quite a few. So I thought, I'm just going to make a list of all the women that work in the different areas of the tech industry. And that started off with like 100 or so. It's now over 500. It's essentially, I'm now a database administrator.
Have you ready for GDPR?
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah, God, yeah. Oh, don't even get me started. So kind of, it basically ended up with me thinking, what can I do practically? And I put it out there and said to people, look, if you're running an event and you need help, I've got this community of women that I am part of, and you know, I'm happy to try and help. You can make introductions and so on and so forth. And that's kind of slightly taken on a bit of a life of its own. I had some demand to actually run events bringing together the women on that list, which so I ran two of those last year. They were really good. They were at Expedia and at Moo. Mm-hmm. And we had kind of Amazon Web Services kindly sponsored some drinks and so on and so forth. And yeah, so that was all pretty successful. And then I've also just had people approach me and ask, can you help more broadly with diversity in terms of stuff like recruiting or sort of policies internally? So yeah, it's been a bit of an interesting one. Slightly, I don't really know what I'm doing, but trying to improve things a bit.
I don't think with this stuff actually, anybody who says they know what they're doing shouldn't be trusted, quite frankly, because they're either lying or they're wrong. Diversity in the industry is something that I've found really interesting for a long while, and I think one of the challenges I see at the moment is it's become a compliance exercise, and I think actually things like the recent release of gender pay balances and that kind of stuff I think is important, but I think risks further this stuff becoming compliance exercises.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I think there's also a degree of, and frankly, some of the kind of people that have approached me to ask about this, you can sort of tell are more interested in the optics of it than actually addressing, you know, why this is good for your business and why this will help you. I mean, for example, things like we constantly hear within tech that there's a talent shortage. And you think, well, if you're only attracting a small group of a whole of society, then it's going to be pretty difficult to address that. So it's sort of an industry-wide issue, purely from a sort of skills point of view, in a way.
And in terms of the positive benefits of becoming more diverse, I mean, for me, the core of it is actually if you've got more diversity, you're better able to be able to suit the needs of the people you're delivering services to.
Yeah.
And you're also more creative because you've got a broader set of backgrounds and experience to which to come up with ideas. And again, I think one of the other challenges I see is particularly where things become besotted around visible indications of diversity, it becomes we now have X number of women working in our department, but we've made them all think the same. And that, I think, is the other challenge within this.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I completely agree with that. I think that a lot of it is around basically challenging received wisdom and avoiding groupthink. And I think that is a huge benefit. And it's an interesting one because I think people, you know, there's a lot of different phrases. People now talk about D&I departments, inclusion and diversity and inclusion. And people use lots of different terms for it. But I think it's important to remember as well that, you know, this is a much wider issue than gender. And there's things like people talk now about neurodiversity, and and also looking at people from different kind of economic backgrounds, or so I think it's something that we have to think about a lot more broadly than just sort of ticking a box of gender or, you know, ethnicity, stuff like that. It's a complex issue.
With helping people to get more diversity in terms of events, have you found that there's been, if you've got an environment where people aren't seeing other people doing it, what do we need to do to be able to encourage people, whether it's women or whether it's people from different ethnic groups or whether it's younger people or older, whatever? What are the steps we need to do to be able to help them have the confidence to be in that probably quite alien environment?
Yeah, and that is a big part of it. In fact, I've actually had a couple of people ask me this year if I can run an event that's aimed at basically coaching people on public speaking. And that is definitely part of it. I mean, part of the issue is frankly, from as far as I can tell, that people don't ask women often enough to actually do this. But that isn't the only problem. I think that from what I can tell, women can also be more reluctant to say yes when they are asked. So there is definitely also an issue from that point of view. I think, what can we do? Well, a good place to start would be getting women to speak in a slightly less intimidating environment. So there's a group called 300 Seconds who do sort of lightning talks, basically. So they just get women to speak for 5 minutes in a very friendly and quite kind of intimate atmosphere. And I think sort of starting with something like that, and then you can gradually build your way up, and then it doesn't feel quite so scary to be asked to speak. But to be honest with you, I get terrified about public speaking, and I often, my initial instinct is pretty much always to say no. So I understand where people are coming from. I force myself not to, because it would be a bit ridiculous for the woman that goes on about women speaking publicly to say no.
but
so I get where that's coming from. And imposter syndrome, and I completely understand that. I still think, you know, why am I don't have any idea what I'm doing. Why am I being asked to talk about this?
Well, I did a talk at Silicon Beach last year, which is all about imposter syndrome.
Oh, right.
And at some point, Matt Desmay will get the video completed to somebody else might be able to watch it. But actually, my argument on that is actually imposter syndrome is what we need, and we should embrace it rather than trying to overcome it.
Yeah.
Because actually, a lot of the challenges that, and this again comes back to this whole thing about why diversity is important. Mm. We need to have people looking at things and saying, "I don't know," rather than saying, "I know what the answer to this is."
Mm.
And again, actually, one of the challenges I think with the established wisdom in IT, particularly tech more broadly, is lots of people going around going, "Oh, I know the answer to that."
No, I think you definitely have a point. I think that the good thing about it is that it keeps you curious, and it keeps you sort of humble to an extent. So it keeps you quite open to ideas. I think you're right. You don't want to kind of squash that completely. I guess it's just treading that fine line between sort of not getting arrogant, but also not suffering from crippling self-doubt all the time. I agree. A little bit of an imposter syndrome can go a long way.
Do you think events are maybe the problem in terms of that you know, audience, person at podium preaching to audience, everybody sitting in receive mode?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think the way we do events is actually really quite broken. For example, I've been to a few sort of unconferences. That can be slightly irritating as a format as well. But there is the benefit of feeling that anyone can contribute, people can come up with ideas and so on and so forth. I think, I think that's definitely an issue. And I much prefer events where it's really about lots and lots of conversations going on rather than everyone receiving a bit of information from someone up on high. But I agree. I think the way we do events definitely is.
I guess there's probably challenges there that this is something actually I've spoken to Ed at CIO about a fair bit. There's an expectation in the tech industry that events are free.
Mm.
So in the IT industry, apart from things like Gartner Symposium, most people expect to be able to go for free.
Yeah.
Which means somebody's got to pay for it, which means you need probably slightly out of touch big tech company with deep pockets to pay for it.
Yeah.
And then because they're flogging something, too many of them will say, "Where's our slot where we can sell?" And I wish I was being over stereotypical about that, but I don't think
no,
I
you're
probably
not.
Are.
I mean, having put on events with, you know, unnamed big tech companies, that definitely happens, that people want their money's worth. People think, right, okay, we want someone to speak from our organisation for this amount of time, or so it's not as altruistic as you know they might think it is when they come into it. So yeah, I think you're right. I think it is an issue of how we fund them, for sure. I don't really know I have no idea what you do to overcome that, to be honest.
I suppose maybe smaller events that are able to be participant funded, where the amount of funding that goes on is smaller.
Yeah.
I think the other challenge, actually, it's interesting with having gone from being working in corporates to working for myself, I make decisions about events that I go to, but when it comes to shall I spend £100 or £300 or whatever to go to an event, I can authorise that payment immediately.
Yeah.
And the amount of just arsing about for people in big corporates to get their employer to pay a trivial amount of money.
Yeah.
That's painful. I think is the reason why so many events went to free to attend.
I think you're right. And also, I think that, funnily enough, I think this actually feeds into the diversity issue, because I think that people, sponsors want to get someone to speak on their behalf if they're you know, paying for an event or contributing towards the payment. And a lot of the time they want someone senior, and a lot of the time that's a white guy. So it's like, you know, I don't know, it's a bit of a funny one. It does mean that you have a bit of a sort of self-reinforcing issue there. And I think a lot of the time the issue with events is that people think we need someone really senior. And actually, most of the most interesting events I've been to have been someone who's just a step down from the really senior person who's actually doing all the work.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I wish that we could break away from that thinking, oh, we've got to just get the really senior person to talk. I'm like, get someone who's doing an interesting project that's like right in the middle of it and, you know, sort of having to grapple with hard issues, rather than someone that's just at the top sort of slightly surveying the scene
with a bunch of confirmation bias and reverse attribution to how things happened. How we were successful, but it's all BS anyway.
Yeah, and it's really good to go to a talk and hear someone just be like, well, we really messed up. And like, and we know this is all the stuff we did wrong. So yeah, I think definitely you're right. Part of the issue is the nature of events. So I think we should, if they could be a bit more casual and a bit and feature speakers that are a little bit less senior, I think that would help quite a lot.
What speaking as a white middle class middle aged man, part of the bloody problem. But what can people like me do to make this better?
Yeah, that's a great question. One very simple thing, and this might be difficult because it involves people having to sidestep their egos to an extent. If you get asked to speak, and this doesn't apply quite so much to you because you're freelance, if you're in a corporate or, you know, in a company of any description, and you are in that position of relative privilege, if you get asked to speak and there's actually a woman or someone from a different kind of background to you that might be able to talk about it just as well, or maybe even better, maybe try and say, oh, why don't you do it, or try and push. So I would say sort of supporting, pushing forward other colleagues. I'm not saying that, you know, we should like exterminate all kind of,
I don't know, we are responsible for a lot of ill in the world, so
all trace of sort of privilege from tech events. But yeah, I just think a little bit of stepping aside and saying, oh, how about, you know, this person that I work with does this instead of me. So yeah, I think that, and also just calling out, I think the particular thing that I focused on a lot is really just all male panels, because I think that's surely just such an egregious form of bias that, and it's also so visible and easy to sort of see how you can tackle it. So yeah, I think calling stuff out. So yeah, sidestepping a bit and calling stuff out.
Are there events or organisers who you think are doing really well at this?
Yes, definitely. Actually, funnily enough, Ed Quiltro on CIO does a really good job of getting events to be fairly kind of mixed and a good gender balance and so on and so forth. But yeah, there are a few. In fact, do you know, I wish I could think of them all straight off the top of my head. I'm actually in the middle of doing some research, which will be coming out shortly, and it'll be an online interactive dashboard, and it will be all of the top 50 London tech events and their gender ratios for their speaker slots.
Interesting.
So watch this space. That research will be coming out, so you'll be able to see for yourself who's doing well and who isn't. Because I know it's a slightly crude metric, but I think it's actually about time that we kind of start to say, look, these people are actually really crap at this. And I'm hoping that a little bit of public shaming might make people wake up and go, okay, this kind of matters. Mm-hmm. Even if it is purely just because they don't want to get shouted at on Twitter, I still think, you know, a bit of a nudge in the right direction could go a long way.
And if people are looking to organise events and are struggling to find diverse sets of speakers or panel members,
talk to me. Just, you know, tweet Twitter. At me. That's all. That always works. Email me, whatever. You know, turn up in person. Well, ideally, don't do that. But you know, but if you really, really want to, talk to me, and I'll help.
That's a fantastic conversation, Matt, and some, you know, interesting thoughts on how we make almost, it's almost about making events more suitable for a diverse audience. But then you have to start to think about what is diversity. And it made me think of, I saw something from Simon Wardley on Twitter today where it can be a snarky so-and-so, can't you, old Wardley? But it was his presentation on diversity, and he put it on Twitter, and it was one page and it one slide, and it said something like, "Welcome to my talk on diversity. Now, you have to think, why have you come to this room to listen to an old white dude talk about diversity? That is the end of my presentation." And maybe that's a problem with us talking about diversity.
Well, yeah, okay. I think the thing, there is a problem with the way in which events run that isn't about the makeup of the speakers on the stage. It's the fact that we have speakers on a stage. And there's a whole bunch of things around how, you know, I know it from presenting, from running training courses, all sorts of things. If you stick somebody up on a stage and then people in rows in front of them, there's so much cultural significance about that setup that it just forces certain behaviours. And I'm not sure that they're behaviours that are particularly good for fostering new relationships, networking, really exploring ideas. And I saw, Tom, I can't remember his name, big marketing tweety bloke who I have conversations with occasionally, who was out at TED this week just gone, and he said that the TED speakers are absolutely, you know, they're top of their game in their industry, and they are rehearsed to the ground, and there was incredibly polished nothing. And that kind of, for me, is where the whole, you know, traditional events where you've got keynotes going through is heading. And actually just being able to get together and, you know, having a small session meeting up in a pub is far more valuable a lot of the time than these big showpiece things that, I don't know. And then you get into the questions we discussed about, you know, how they're funded, and if you've got to not have anybody paying to get through the door, then how that means you have a sponsor that determines certain models of how the thing works, and then you get the Duff sponsor presentation and the da-da-da-da-da. And actually finding ways to be able to really challenge and do things differently maybe is the underlying problem.
I think that's true. I think part of the problem is we can agonise about this, can't we, a little bit, and we can wring our hands about, is this right, is that right? I mean, I'm at the point now where I'm so sensitive to this sort of stuff, and I almost call it guff and nonsense, but it isn't really, that when you said a meeting in a pub is just as well, I thought, well, but there's a lot of people that don't feel comfortable going to a pub, and there's a lot of, that will exclude a bunch of people, and that's, again, almost, you know, almost back to our AI conversation about bias. You're introducing your own biases because you're going to meet the kind of people that are like you. And that's sometimes a bit of, that requires some thinking about. But then you start to get to the point, well, we must be able to appease the people that, you know, are allergic to leather, and we must appease the people that have got an aversion to bright lights, and we must appease the people who don't like the dark, and all of this kind of thing, where it just becomes self-defeating. You start, everything, would be called in the Daily Mail or something, it would be politically correctness gone mad. And we have to be able to work in a way that's sensible, as well as be mindful of the whole diversity thing. But again, you know, there I am talking about it as somebody as privileged as I am to be male, white, handsome, intelligent, etc.
Face for radio, dear boy. Face for radio. Anyway, thank you very much to Charlotte for making the time. It was a fascinating chat, and we'll put some links on to her and the ventures she's got if you want to find out more. So there we go, another wonderful week. What have you got in the week ahead?
Well, I've got more time in that London, doing some work on some MOJ stuff, and then I've got to go to Birmingham for something on Friday, meeting some people, so a bit more work. So that's it's just really busy, and another good one to look forward to. How about yourself?
Excellent. I have got Silicon Beached in London on Wednesday, which I'm thoroughly looking forward to, and it's going to make me feel really old, I think, because This year, Matt Desmier has programmed 20 speakers, all of whom are under the age of, I think, 25. And that's going to be fascinating, but also probably deeply terrifying. As
well, I can't. What's somebody under 25 got to tell me? Nothing. That's
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And then the CIO 100 Awards on Thursday night, which should be good fun. And I think there's something else coming up, but I can't remember what it was. Oh, yeah, no, I'm going to go and watch Leighton Orient play on Saturday, just for a bit of lower league action.
I can imagine. I wish I could be there, Matt, but sadly I can't.
Oh, there you go. I'm bored of the Premier League with Watford now. So, yeah, it's the O's for me in the Beza Homes League, or whatever it's called these days. Anyway. So there we go. Next week on the show, we've got an interview with Hilary Gallo, talking about his new forthcoming book and all about fear. It should be good. Well, it is good because I know because I've already done it. And then I've got a couple more interviews in the bag as well. So it's going to just be interview-tastic for the next few weeks, which takes pressure off us. So there we go. Join us then. Oh, and the other thing is, I think this week we will be launching the new exciting short mini pod called Draw Pod, which is a little collaboration I've been doing with Natalia, who was on the show last year, earlier this year. And so all about drawing on the radio. So we'll slip that out into the WB40 podcast stream. So you might be picking that up in the next few days, and it will be launching on its own website and stuff as well. So keep an ear out for that one. Anyway, have a good week, and see you next week.
As always, you can find us on the internet at wb40podcast.com, on Twitter at wb40podcast, and on all good, reliable podcast services. And of course, you can join our WhatsApp group, and there's a link on the website which allows you to do that too.